You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we have a sort of varied fantasy theme to the show today, really. Our studio guest is Mick Finlay. He's talking about his new novel, Arrowwood. We'll also hear from Mandy Morton on Magical Mystery Paws, the latest in her number two feline detective agency series. And Jacob Sagar Weinstein will be talking about his book, The City of Secret Rivers. It's the first book in a comic fantasy trilogy. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Mick.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But both Mandy and Jacob's book, part of a series. Arrowwood, this is the first of a series, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The second one's coming out in January, and I'm just in the last stages of writing the third one.
And did you always know it was going to be a series?
I'd always hoped it was a series. It really depended on whether the first one ever got published. But yes, as soon as it was, then yeah, I was intending it to be a series. I tried to leave enough strands in the first one that I could develop later on.
And when you realise that it's going to be a series, do you feel differently about the characters you're writing? Do you have to write it slightly differently?
I think you have licence to leave a lot of open narrative lines that you can develop later. But I was conscious that I had to give them, for a crime novel, a level of complexity which would allow me to expand them later on in future books, rather than give them enough that made it interesting. A little bit of a family difficulty, perhaps a small alcohol problem, which is all known in crime novels very well, but which, you know, you couldn't necessarily develop much further. I tried to open those things out a bit more.
So do you know where they're going?
No, I've no idea. I mean, I know where they went in the second book, and as I'm just finishing the third book, I know where they are now. I have no idea where they're going to go for the fourth book. But, I mean, I had an idea just when I started to write the third book of a situation I could put the narrator in, which I really hadn't expected, and that opened up a lot for me for his character in the third book. So I hope it does work that way, that I try and put them in challenging situations and see what and not necessarily dangerous situations, but emotionally challenging situations or socially challenging situations, and try and see where that can lead.
And I guess the idea is you wouldn't always get somebody who'll read the third in the series as a standalone novel, but what you really want is somebody who's going to follow those characters all the way through the series.
Yeah, it's quite difficult. I suppose it's like writing a soap opera, that you should be able to tune in at any part of a soap opera and just follow it through from there. And it should be like that in a series of crime novels. I know that if you've read it from the start, you'll understand some of the things a bit better. There'll be more context to it, which will be slightly richer. But you have to write it so that you can just pick it up, that it's enjoyable enough and understandable even without reading any of the others.
Well, we'll hear all about Arrowwood in the show, but we'll hear your first choice of music. Now, is music important to you, Mick? I'm guessing it is, because you were very specific about these tracks. Your first track of music is North Country Blues by Bob Dylan, but it's had to be the version on the Times They Are A-Changing album.
Yeah, well, particularly with Bob Dylan, because he's my greatest hero and has been since I was about 17, but I can't stand listening to him live. Right. I hate his live voice. In my opinion, he ruins all his songs when he sings them live. And also, it's young Bob Dylan I like, so the version was very important.
Come and gather round, friends, and I'll tell you a tale of when the red iron armpits run aplenty, put the cardboard filled windows and old men on the benches. tell you now that the whole town is empty. In the north end of town, my own children have grown. Well, I was raised on the other, in the wee hours of youth, my mother took sick, and I was brought up by my brother. The iron ore poured as the years passed the door. The drag lines and shovels, he was humming, till one day my brother failed to come home. The same as my father before him. With a long winter's wait from the window I watched. My friends, they couldn't have been kinder. And my school aid was cut as I quit in the spring.
That's North Country Blues by Bob Dylan, the first choice of music on Bookmark today by our studio guest Mick Finley. Mick teaches psychology and has published research on political violence, persuasion and verbal and non-verbal behaviour. His first novel, Arrowwood, was published in paperback this year. The Times listed it as one of their top 100 summer books and said it crackled with energy and wit. The Daily Telegraph made it a pick of the week, and it's been chosen as one of the best crime mystery novels of 2017 by the Seattle Times, The Strand magazine and Audiophile magazine. The Spectator said of the eponymous hero, Arrowwood is a fantastic creation, sweating, beetroot red of face, his stomach bulging, but he works with subtlety, decoding emotions, reading expressions and gestures, seeking evidence in the things that are said or unsaid, understanding human psychology. Well, Mick, the physical description aside of Arrowwood, it seems that you have a lot in common with him in terms of the psychological side of things and looking at the world that way.
That's right, yeah. I came up with the idea for Arrowwood when reading Sherlock Holmes stories and thinking if I was a detective in Sherlock Holmes's London, I would be very envious of Holmes's success and his apparent genius. And there were, in fact, quite a few private detectives working in London in the 1890s when Sherlock Holmes was supposed to be operating. So, and it was then I came up with the idea for the character, but to write the book, I felt, well, I had to make a character who is the opposite of Holmes. Now, and Holmes prides himself in using the logic and powers of deduction and his great stores of expert knowledge on various in various spheres. So, and he doesn't like emotions. And he says this repeatedly, that emotions interfere with his ability to solve crimes. So I thought, well, if I was going to have a rival detective who hated Sherlock Holmes, he had to use the alternative method. And so therefore he, and luckily as I'm a psychologist, psychology was the obvious answer.
He loathes Holmes, doesn't he?
And really
he claims it's all down to luck, really,
yeah.
That Holmes... It kind of blew my mind on a meta level, really, because you've got a fictional character in what feels like a very real London, referencing, and not just another, one more fictional character. He also references Kate Atkinson's Witcher as well.
Well, that he was actually real.
Oh, okay. So you've got one real, and you've got Darwin in there and Jack the Ripper, and Sherlock Holmes. On a meta level, it's quite challenging for the reader.
Yeah, it's quite challenging for me as well, actually, because I've read a lot of Sherlock Holmes in writing the book to try and, because there's some cases that Arrowwood picks to pieces to say this is just guesswork. But Sherlock Holmes London doesn't have all those real characters in them. So it doesn't have Jack the Ripper, even though that was the biggest crime of the period. Sherlock Holmes doesn't solve that crime, and it's never mentioned. And he doesn't mention Darwin and all those great things that were going on.
Yeah, so it was a time of great change, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and
it was
real
a
development
time.
And evolution, literally.
Yeah, absolutely. And so many, and that's really when psychology started, I think. Not philosophical psychology, but proper people really trying to understand the processes of the mind and how crowds worked and things like that. Freud was writing, but only in German at that point. It hadn't been translated into English. So I have to sort of manage these two worlds. Mostly it's real. It's about real stuff. I mean, I've read so much history to try and make it real, social history. But Sherlock Holmes is probably the, and Arrowood, of course, who's fictional. They're the only two things that aren't real. And the cases are not real either, but everything else is real.
Well, for people who haven't read the book, give us a brief summary of it without giving too much away.
Well, it has the same structure as the Sherlock Holmes novel. So the narrator is Arrowood's assistant, but is more working class than Watson was. And he's more of the rough. So he narrates the book, and a young French woman comes to see Arrowood to say her brother has disappeared and could he help find the man. And Arrowood doesn't see this as a very interesting case, so he's a bit reluctant. But she becomes very upset. She's convinced something's happened to him, so he agrees. And then he quickly discovers that the man worked in a pub called the Barrel of Beef, which is owned and run by one of the most vicious crime bosses in South London, and one who's already threatened to kill Arrowood if he ever sees him again. So quickly they get drawn into this very dangerous world, which involves a Fenian conspiracy, and also involves sex crimes, a network of pornographers, and also involves a scandal which was going on at the time in Victorian England, which was it was called the Maiden Tribute, which is where young working class English girls were enticed over to France as to be maids in rich households, but when they arrived in France they'd be imprisoned in brothels, and young French girls were also enticed over to England, and the same happened to them.
That's real, is it?
That's a real, yeah. There was a big scandal, and there was a journalist called William Steed who was very angry that nobody was doing anything about this. And to expose it, he bought a girl through this network, and then wrote a bit of campaigning journalism about how easy it was to buy a young girl from France to try and get somebody to do something about it. So, yeah, it was a massive scandal in late Victorian England.
Was that one of the reasons you set it in that particular time period? There is a lot going on. I mean, obviously, when you set it in the past, you're losing things like forensic knowledge that we have now, CCTV footage, mobile phones, all of that.
Yeah.
But you have this really earthy underbelly going on, if you like. Was that what appealed to you?
It did. I mean, the reason I set it there was because the idea was it had to happen in Sherlock Holmes's time. I really didn't know very much about the history, but the more I read about it, the more I thought, this is really lucky, because it was an incredible time. It was full of awful, awful things, but also full of grand ideas and great political arguments. A lot of the debates we're having now, they were having then, about things like globalization, and which is why I chose that Bob Dylan song, because that although that was a song from the 1960s, it's so it speaks to Trump's America now. It's exactly what Trump was trying to appeal to, is those people whose industries had all been shut down because it's easier to buy stuff from abroad. But they were having those arguments in Victorian England as well. The Dutch bacon was coming over, and the pig farmers were, you know, wanting tariffs imposed, and they were starting to import meat from New Zealand and things like this. So those great arguments, and I didn't realise this before I started writing the book, but I mean, a lot of the debates we're still having, they were having then.
So you were led to that time period by Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
Really. What is it with Sherlock Holmes? Because Arrowood is obsessed with him as well, and you know, in a dismissive way, but can't shake him off. What is it that appeals to you about Holmes?
I love the Holmes stories for many reasons. So Holmes is an early version of a superhero, because he's very athletically competent. He's an expert boxer and swordsman. He's got a massive brain. He's aloof and charismatic. And he has these areas of specialised knowledge which he's really studied hard. And he brings all of these to bear and does things that nobody else can do. So he has that superhero appeal. Conan Doyle writes those stories beautifully as well. I mean, his descriptions of his characters are absolutely wonderful. And he also taps on some of the, you know, great tragedies of the time. So they're usually stories linked to the colonial adventures and things that happened over there. He's not very good with poverty and things like this, but he is good with sort of social values of the time, race and things. There's a great story about a young mixed-race child who wears a yellow mask called the Yellow-Faced Child, which deals in a heartbreaking way with issues of race in Victorian society. So the Sherlock Holmes stories have a wealth of these, of different things to enjoy in them.
So it must have been nice when you got a review from the Strand magazine, because that was the magazine that Conan Doyle used to write for.
Exactly, yeah. I was so happy when that happened. I was so happy. I thought they might hate it.
In relief.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a sidestep for a moment. Do you like cats, Mick?
I like dogs.
Right, OK. Shall we read into that? Cats, cats are second. They get the silver medal. Well, we'll hear about cats now. Mandy Morton began her professional life as a musician, releasing six albums and touring extensively with her band Spriggans of Tolgas. She then worked as a broadcaster with BBC Radio and is a regular contributor with her wife, crime writer Nicola Upson, to the Cambridge 105 radio schedule. Magical Mystery Paws is the latest in her popular series of books about the number two feline detective agency. I started my interview with Mandy by asking her if she ever thought that having been successful as both a musician and a broadcaster, she'd then go on to have a third career as a writer.
No, not at all, not in the slightest. When I hung up my guitar strings back in the sort of early 80s, it was because of touring that I did that. Enough was enough. I mean, after sort of 13 years of being on the road and not quite waking up in which town you thought, I mean, that's the thing, I gave up and threw my lot in with broadcasting. Never in a million years would I think that I would actually sit down long enough to write a book.
For those who haven't read the books, can you give us a little bit about what they're about and what this particular one is about?
Yeah, I mean, it's semi-autobiographical because I sort of grab something from my own life in each of the books, but it's an entire world of cats, no people at all, which is actually quite refreshing for me.
what a nice world that would be, with a world of
well
cats.
Yeah, but and the interesting thing is that cats can be lovely, they can be cruel and vicious, calculating, they can be everything that the worst people in our societies can be, and they can be everything that the nicest people. So they just seem to be the perfect vehicle to put out these stories. So it's an imaginary 1970s, where of course I spent a lot of my time here in Cambridge, so always in my mind I'm thinking Mill Road area. The characters within the books, the lead characters who return each time, Hetty and Tilly run the number two feline detective agency. They are our own cats who sadly are no longer here, but what's fabulous is you can breathe life back into them again. And in the process of writing the books, of course, other friends' cats have gone to the Elysian Fields in the sky, so some of them feature as regular characters too. It's just a lovely way of actually playing with two worlds, our human world and the world of a cat.
I know you love your cats and you always have cats. So what stage did you look at your cats and think, do you know what, I could write about these, turn them into characters?
When they died, I took a year off broadcasting after I stood down from the BBC after 26 years, goodness me, and it was the first winter. And the winter came on, and obviously in summertime I love my gardens and allotments and all of that, and the winter came on and I just suddenly sat at my desk one day, no editing to do, no interviews particularly that I was bothered about, and thought, oh, so what happens for the next 6 months while I sit and freeze in the winter? And for some unknown reason the first paragraph arrived and that was it. Also, at the time, I was very keen to raise some money for the Blue Cross animal charity. We have a fabulous cat rehoming centre here in Cambridge that I do a lot of work for. And I thought, well, this is great. I'll self-publish. I don't want any of the razzmatazz of the publishing industry or anything that goes with it. I'll create a nice little book and sell it on their behalf. And that's exactly what I did. But lo and behold, a publisher picked it up. So then I was sort of bucketed into the real world of publishing, which means deadlines and all the manners that go with it and tours. So that's really how it, well, showed itself. But the ongoing thing is that the, you know, the total that we're raising goes up and up at the Blue Cross. It's always lovely there. They put me in the magazine at Christmas now and all that sort of stuff. So it's job done there. But of course I have to come up with a new story at least once a year, if not twice.
Well, I was going to say, this is the sixth in the series, is that right?
Yep.
So yes, what started out as a little idea on a board, wet and cold.
It's the story of my life, isn't it? You know, I sang one song at a folk club and had 13 years of professional music career, so there we go.
Oh, well, you should have known while you were letting yourself. But these have been massively successful. I mean, that must be so rewarding.
It is absolutely lovely, and particularly as the books are quite satirical. So you can take them at face value and go, ah, isn't this cute, isn't this cosy? Until you come to a murder, and then you think, oh, ouch, that's not quite as cosy as I thought this book was going to be. And so what's lovely is that the more people become aware of the books, the more they take them on those two levels, because I tackle some quite hard-hitting issues. I mean, like euthanasia, homelessness, of course. So there's a lot of homeless cats out there, and they're not necessarily all with fur and whiskers. And blending in that little bit of biographical thread, because they always say that you should write about what you know. And I've had an absolute ball with Magical Mystery Pause because it very much relates to my touring years with the band. And I've given Hetty all my thoughts in this book about what it's like to be on tour, particularly in the 1970s, when you didn't have the razzmatazz of fabulous tour buses and everybody looking after you. Literally, it was the way the Beatles started, you know, in an old van racing up and down the motorway.
Oh, bless her. And Hetty's living on in the books. That's nice for you
as
well.
Of course, of course.
So who are the books aimed at? Because people think cats, they might think children, but as you say, you're tackling...
Yeah, anything from 12 years up, I think, because they do smoke quite a lot of catnip in the book. And it's always a delight to have a sort of 13 or 14-year-old come up for a book signing to say this is their favourite book of all time. I don't suppose it's any crueler than things like Harry Potter, really, when it comes down to it. But essentially, it's also quite tongue-in-cheek for very grown-up people who will get a lot of the nuances, I think, within the book as well, some of which are quite outrageous.
And as you say, the cats that inspired it, they've gone to the big litter tray in the sky, but you've got new cats now. Are they featuring in the books?
Yeah, well, sadly, we lost Molly Bloom last October. She has not been replaced, but we have a new incoming person who is called Betsy Trotwood, so we have her at the moment. She's a four-year-old and driving us mad because we usually adopt elderly pussycats, but she came to the RSPCA in a very bad state, so we decided that we'd go with that one. But Molly Bloom we adopted when she was getting on a bit from the Blue Cross, and although I couldn't bear to include her in this book because obviously the grief sets in, she will be having a starring role in the next one along from this one. So, and I've even decided what she's going to do in the book, and she will be a regular stock character as well.
And what an industrious household it must be, because, you know, your partner Nicola, she's a writer as well. She's got deadlines. Deadlines ever crash?
No, we try not to. We try, both of us, to write in the winter with the best will in the world, but then our publishers want us to promote the books, so they come out at different times of the year. And Nicola had a very busy autumn and Christmas time because of Nine Lessons and based here in Cambridge, etc. But this time round, she has just delivered her brand new book, which won't be out, of course, for another 18 months or so. And my book arrived on the doorstep this week as a finished copy. So actually, there's been much celebration in the house. She's got rid of her manuscript and then it goes into process. And mine has actually arrived as a book. So there's always something going on. And of course, we do now do some events together. We call it Malice Domestic. Because we both help each other out with the books. We do lots of research, travelling away all over the place, particularly for Nicola's books, because they have to be very heavily researched, because she bases them in the 20s and 30s.
And you've got the book in front of you.
Yes.
You're going to read a little bit for it.
Yes, if you'd like me
to. Yes.
Let me set the scene. It's a boiling hot day in the book, and Hetty and Tilly are sitting in the garden of their landladies. That's the Butters, who run the bakery in the books. And Popper Fiend, their friend, the black and white cat, has just arrived for afternoon tea with them with some very exciting news. So here we go. The black and white cat threw himself onto a lush patch of lawn, and Tilly handed him the last of the ham rolls. "What do you mean by an adventure?" asked Hetty, scraping some patisserie cream off her fur. Popper poked the final piece of ham roll into his mouth and chewed slowly, as if thinking of a good place to start. Tilly moved forward on her deck chair. Seeing that his audience was waiting patiently, Popper began. "Well, I got myself in a bit of a fix, really. I've been doing some running round for Patty Sniff lately. She's been in Tabby Road recording her latest album with her new band, the Cheese Triangles." Tilly stifled a giggle as Popper continued. "Anyway, as you probably know, Patty is blind. That's why she's called Patty Sniff. Her real name is Fiona Foxglove, and she's been off the road for a bit on account of her creative juices drying up. The new album is make or break for her, but she's got to go on tour or she's dead in the water. That's where I come in. I've put some dates together, but the venues wouldn't take her on her own, so I've had to add a few acts to bulk things out a bit. We're calling it the Summer of Fluff Tour." Tilly was now on the very edge of her seat with excitement and preempted Hetty by jumping in with both front paws. "And you'd like us to help with the tour?" "Well, let's just put it this way. I have a number of senior tour personnel to engage, and I thought this would be right up your street." Tilly clapped her paws together and danced round her deck chair as Hetty aired a cautious note. "What sort of things would you need us to do?" Oh, I need a bus driver, so that'd be good for Bruiser. Then I'll need costume and backstage production, and I thought Tilly might be good at that. A steady pair of paws is just what's needed. Tilly could hardly contain herself in spite of the heat. She felt the urge to skip round the butter's lawn, kicking up the dust storm as she went. But Hetty needed further convincing. So what have you got in mind for me? She asked. Oh, the top job, of course, responded Popper, knowing that an ego massage was the only way to go with his old friend. Let's face it, he continued, no one knows the road like you do. All these tours we did, all those scrapes we got in and out of, breakdowns, weather, power cuts, we had the lot. I want to put you in charge of the whole thing. Who else could do the job? Hetty suddenly felt flooded with a new sense of purpose. Her music days had brought her great joy. She'd been reasonably successful with her band, and she sometimes missed the call of the open road. But there was so much more to be discussed before she was ready to nail her colours to the summer of fluff mast. So we've got six performers to look after, said Hetty. Well, that shouldn't be too bad. Ah, said Popper. Then there's the Irish dance troupe. The what? Exclaimed Hetty. There's six of them, plus Bouba, their French dance mistress. They're straight from a season of river dance. There used to be seven, but one of them drowned in the grand finale.
That's Magical Mystery Pause by Mandy Morton, is published by Farrago. Nine Lessons by Nicola Epson, which we talked about there as well, and I would recommend to you. It's published by Faber and Faber. And you can hear both Mandy and Nicola in the Eclectic Light Show on this station talking about music, art and theatre. Visit our website, cambridge105.co.uk, for more details. Mick, do you know Nicola? Because it's a small world, the crime writing world, particularly in Cambridge. Have you met Nicola?
No, but we're doing an event together in the Festival of Ideas.
You will all meet each other. Yeah, yes, there's so many crime writers in Cambridge.
Yeah, I didn't realise that, actually. And I've only met one in Cambridge, Alison Bruce, but I'm hoping to
meet there's many more. And Mandy, they're talking about the first time she put pen to paper, that sort of winter's afternoon when she didn't really have any other work on. Can you remember what prompted you to think, do you know what, I'll write a novel?
No, her books sound great.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, they do. I can't remember. I wrote for quite a few years before Arrowwood came along as an idea. It took me a long time to learn to write. That's all I can say about it. In fact, I think I had to find the right genre, because I hadn't tried to write a crime fiction novel before, and I think it suited me much better than what I was trying to write previously.
Yeah, I think you can say you can write now, published by HarperCollins, three books in. Let's hear your second choice of music now, which is Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Helpless. And this is from, what album is this from? You wanted this from Decade by Neil Young. Why this one? Why this version?
Well, actually, it's also on a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young album, but I've heard him play it on his own without a band. This is another great problem with country music, is that sometimes they'll play a song which sounds great with a full band. When you hear people playing it on their own, it's not quite as good. So.
There you are. Enjoy.
Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our studio guest on Bookmark today is Mick Finlay, talking about his crime novel Arrowwood. We're going to hear an extract from that now. Mick, do you want to give us some context to this?
Arrowwood and Barnett I can't remember where it starts. It's about halfway through the book, and they're in the middle of some very important crime-solving work, and they're visited by two policemen two Irish policemen who, and that's important for the story, but I won't say why. I think that's where it starts.
I think you're right. Yeah. Yes, let's listen to it.
They didn't talk to us all the way to Scotland Yard. They led us down into the basement and into a grey room with one small, clouded window up high by the ceiling. In the middle was a table with six chairs around it. And when we were seated, Lafferty and Coyle left the room, locking the steel door behind them. And when they did finally return, after nearly 4 hours, they offered no apology.
Where have you been?
Demanded the governor.
You've kept us here half a day.
We had business to attend to,
replied Lafferty, dropping a tin ashtray onto the table, along with a memo book and a pencil.
So had we,
protested the governor.
You better make this quick.
They acted as if he hadn't spoken. Coyle stood by the door, while Lafferty strode up and down, asking us questions. And when we told all we knew, Lafferty sat down at the table opposite us, and he nodded to Coyle, who put his notebook away, stuck his hands in his pockets, and began to ask all the questions again, just using different words this time. And as it went on, I could see the governor getting more and more riled.
I'm a private investigative agent,
replied the governor.
And I've worked on more cases than you can imagine.
Not like Sherlock Holmes, though, are you now, sir? We ain't read about you in the papers, have we?
The governor shook his head, a great sad frown on his face.
Oh dear, oh dear. So the CID idolised Sherlock Holmes just like the rest of the country. How disappointing. I'd hope Scotland Yard would have better men.
Coyle flushed.
You think a lot of yourself, don't you, Arrowood? Don't tell me you could solve the case as he did. Holmes is the minds of four men.
And at this, Lafferty rolled his eyes. He clearly didn't share Coyle's opinion.
Take the Mormon case,
Coyle continued, gripping the back of his chair.
Do you know that one?
The corpse found in a house of Brixton Road,
replied the governor, wearily.
Thomas Drebber.
There ain't a man in England could have pieced that case together the way he did. CID couldn't have done it. Not even Witcher could have solved that one.
But Holmes didn't solve that case,
said the governor, firmly.
Of course he solved it. It's all there, written down. He got the name of the murderer.
Hope,
interrupted the governor. I could see he was brewing up again.
The murderer's name was Hope.
And even led him to Baker Street so they could take him in,
continued Coyle. The governor hopped to his feet, his voice raised.
For pity's sake! All Sherlock Holmes did was phone the Cleveland police, who told him Drebber was being pursued by Hope. He was told the name of the killer, you imbecile. How is that solving the case?
Coyle shook his head stubbornly, saying,
what about the nosebleed and the horse tracks? What about the man's ruddy face and the ring? Holmes read all those clues. None of the others pieced it together.
All lucky guesses,
replied the governor, clasping his head in exasperation.
For each clue he finds, Holmes identifies a couple of possibilities, dismisses one, and declares the other a solution. Take the motive for the murderer. It wasn't burglary. That was clear. Holmes decided it was therefore over a woman, or for a political purpose. He appears ignorant of any other motives for murder. What about vengeance? Perhaps a man's brother had been killed by Drebber. Perhaps he'd been swindled out of a family fortune. Perhaps Drebber had scuttled his ship. What about a crime of insanity? What about blackmail? No, Holmes doesn't consider any of these, nor any other possible motive for murder on God's earth.
But the ring,
said Coyle.
That was proof it was.
It was not proof,
roared the governor, swiping the ashtray, and with it, Coyle's hat to the floor, as if a demon had possessed him.
The presence of the ring could be explained in many other ways. Perhaps in the scuffle it fell from the man's pocket. Perhaps he was on his way to pawn it. Perhaps it was left as a blind. Holmes dismisses the writing on the wall as a blind. So why not the ring? Why not the ring, I ask you? Perhaps Drebber is trying to buy the killer off. And the most serious problem is, again, something Holmes doesn't see. If the ring is really so important, how is it that the killer leaves it at the scene?
The governor was now shrieking, his hands waving wildly in the air. His red face shone. His head appeared to have swelled almost double the size. He slammed his fist on the table. Lafferty and Coyle both watched him in surprise, their mouths wide open.
Any fool can see that this should mean the ring is not important. But again, Holmes is lucky. Against all odds, the killer does leave it. It's a one in a million chance, I tell you. Holmes is proved correct, but only because he missed all the possibilities. And Watson writes it out for the Strand, declaring the man a genius.
The governor stood at the edge of the table, panting, his eyes travelling from Lafferty to Coyle to me. Lafferty tapped his pencil on the table, and Coyle, he leaned against the wall, his arms crossed. Nobody spoke. The governor continued glaring at us, chewing his lip. And then finally, Lafferty said,
"You seem to know a lot about this case, Hammerwood."
The governor's face twitched. He didn't seem so sure of himself all of a sudden. "He reads a lot," I said, standing and taking his shoulder. He was unnaturally hot, and even through the thick fat of his arm, I could feel his pulse beat wildly. I helped him to sit. I retrieved Coyle's hat. I put it back on the table. Mr. Arrowood's always in a book.
And the actors in that extract were Thomas Stockbridge, Steve Hovington, Paul Malpass and Matt Bentman, who also produced the piece. Mr. Arrowood's always in a book. You've got that kind of book within a book, within a book thing that's mind-blowing for readers going on there. But first of all, the physical presence of Arrowood, Mick. Why is that so important? Because he is so visceral there. You know, he's so, in that extract, we feel him. And the way you describe him, he is, he's very, well, he's overweight. He's quite smelly. Why was it important to you that he was like that? You know, he's not a superhero in that sense, is he?
He's not at all a superhero, no. He's a kind man. And he's a thoughtful man, but he's certainly not a superhero. But it's partly my understanding of Victorian life. If I think of the number of things that I need to make my life comfortable, the creams and the painkillers and, you know, all those things that they didn't have, it must have been very uncomfortable for you. You know, if you had maybe a skin conditions, or if you had prone to headaches or stomach, you've had reflux problems, you know, all those things, they just didn't have ways of dealing with it. So I thought, to be more authentic, I'd give him a load of physical problems and make him live with it and battle with them through the more important parts of his life, which was solving the crimes that he had to solve. So it was partly that. And also, watching television dramas nowadays, they so often they put beautiful young people in as the lead characters. And I want to see somebody who's a bit older and is not beautiful, because, you know, it's
yeah, no, you
much
can't be accused
realistic.
Of that. So I think, you know, we're very clear that what he physically looks like. Well, we'll stay with London now. We'll hear from Jacob Sagar Weinstein. He's an American humorist, comedy writer and screenwriter who won a Writers Guild of America award in 2001 for his work on Dennis Miller Live. He's also written for The New Yorker and The Onion. His first novel for young adults, The City of Secret Rivers, was published earlier this year and described by The Guardian as an excellent thriller. When I met Jacob, I asked why, after his experience writing satire and scripts, he decided to write a novel.
Well, in a lot of ways, satire was something that sort of happened accidentally along the way to writing a novel. The reason I became a writer in the first place was I wanted to tell stories. And I sort of stumbled into writing jokes for television. And then because I had done that, I was able to publish some humor books. And those were a lot of fun. But there was never a real continuing story, even in the books. There was nothing that began on page one, and then you had characters progressing. It was much more humor as it went. So this is actually really what I've wanted to do, and everything else was sort of something I stumbled into along the way.
So tell me about The City of Secret Rivers. What's it about?
It is about a young American girl named Hyacinth who moves to London, or maybe I should say is forcibly moved by her eccentric mom. What Hyacinth discovers is that there are secret magical rivers running beneath the streets of London, running through the sewers of London. And unfortunately for her, the way she discovers this is she accidentally unleashes the power of one of them and sets off not only a potential magical catastrophe, but her mom is kidnapped by monsters as a result of this, monsters in Royal Mail uniforms. And so in order to get her back, she has to go on this magical quest through London sewers.
Yeah, you mentioned a few things there. It's a quirky, funny book, so you used your experience from the other forms of writing here.
Yes, absolutely. Although I will say that often the way I write humor is to write things that make perfect sense to me, and then people think they're funny, so I think I just have sort of a naturally comic slant, I guess, on how I see the world.
And set in the sewers of London, why there?
It goes back to the original idea that I had, the inspiration for it. I was walking along Embankment, which is one of my favorite parts of London, just reading sort of a self-guided walking tour, and I learned that Embankment was built just to house sewers. And I thought it was so odd that this beautiful part of London exists just as a conduit for human waste, that I started thinking maybe there's an alternate explanation, and clearly the only logical conclusion is that it's a cover-up for these secret magical rivers running under the city. So because of that initial idea, and this is what I mean when I say it's just all logical to me, clearly, therefore, the adventure must be in the sewers because that's where the magic would be.
So how much research did you have to do into sewers and sewer life?
A great deal, actually. If you go to my home office, which is cramped and messy, one of the many overflowing bookshelves is dedicated to books about London in general, especially underground London, London sewers. One of the things I learned is that the real-life history of the London sewers is sort of amazing and magical and fascinating. And when you learn more about it, Embankment seems less like a curiosity and more like a tribute to this amazing, life-saving engineering project. But even so, I still mind it for weird stuff that I converted to fantasy and magic.
So what fascinating things did you find out then about the sewers of London?
Well, I think the most fascinating thing to me is just how many lives it saved. Some people say that it is the largest engineering project in human history. To give you an idea, there are about 2 million blocks in the Great Pyramids of Egypt, but there are about more than 800 million bricks in the London sewers. If you stretch the London sewers out end to end, they would stretch all the way from the southernmost tip of England to the northernmost tip of Scotland. So it is this massive engineering project that resulted in probably millions of lives saved from cholera, diphtheria, all the diseases that used to happen before there were sewers in London, but it's just there under our feet and we take it completely for granted.
And as you say, the sewers play a central role in the book. They're almost a character. So it's quite a challenge for a writer to bring that atmosphere, the smells, the sights, the sounds to life.
It is. And one of my great disappointments in writing the book, I was able to visit a lot of locations. I was never able to visit the actual sewers themselves. I'm probably one of the only people I know who has visit the sewers as an unfulfilled life goal. I got a chance to visit there's a beautiful Victorian pumping station that most of London's sewage flows into. And the Victorian part is not used anymore. There's a much more functional modern part next to it. But the actual Victorian station is staggeringly beautiful. And it's another example of how this sort of beautiful, almost magical environment comes out of what seems like a very mundane project.
And Hyacinth is the heroine of the book. So you chose to write from the point of view of a girl. Why?
Two reasons for it. One of them I can't tell you until book three comes out. I'll mention that part of what Hyacinth discovers is that it's not just a coincidence that she is the one to unleash the magical powers of these secret rivers. She finds that there's a mysterious connection on her family, on her mother's side, having to do with her aunts, that ties her family, and especially the women in her family, to these sewers. And book three is where you will find out what that connection is, so I can't go too much into that. But the other side of that is that there aren't enough books, I think, that give young girls a chance to have these crazy magical adventures. And I just thought I would just put one little block on the scale on the other side to try to balance that out a little bit more.
And a lot of world building you must have had to do, the rules within this world that you create. Did you know them at the beginning or did they come to you as you wrote?
It took me about 10 years almost from the time I had the first idea to the time I had the finished book in hand. And much of that was spent working out the backstory and the rules of this world. At times it felt like cheating because I'd researched London's history. And because the conceit of this book is that London's history is sort of a cover-up for the real magical history, anytime I'd find something quirky or weird in London's history, I would try to extrapolate what that told me about the rules of the magic and the secret magical history. And there is so much fascinating and quirky and strange in London's history that I had a huge amount to choose from. So on my hard drive, I have an extensive timeline going back centuries of sort of the secret magical events in London, a lot of the backstory, and most of it does not come explicitly into the book, but I always think of that kind of backstory. Maybe this is pretentious, but the way that I think of like a painter learning anatomy, that a painter is not necessarily going to put a skeleton in every painting, but the fact that they know what a skeleton looks like means that their limbs look real when they paint them. So my hope is that you won't feel the weight of this backstory, but it will make the world, as crazy as it is, feel consistent.
But there are fantastical monsters in there as well. I mean, is this science fiction, magical fantasy? How would you define it?
I would say it's fantasy. I've tried to work out the rules with the same consistency, or at least the same internal consistency, that science fiction has. But I think when you have giant shambling mud monsters in Royal Mail uniforms and massive pigs in bathing costumes handing out business cards, it's hard for me to claim that it's hard science.
And what next now? You mentioned book three. Have you finished that? It's obviously a trilogy. Where are you up to?
I finished book two, and that's called The City of Guardian Stones, and that moves the adventures a bit above ground. That comes out in September. Book three is in progress. My process is I write a really awful first draft, and then I do a huge amount of work and bring it up to mediocre, and then eventually, after many drafts, it actually becomes good. I'm proud to say that book three has now achieved mediocre status, but I need to keep... Exactly. So, but I've got a couple more drafts before it's ready to send out into the world.
Speaking to writers who've written trilogies, they all say that book two is the hardest because you're finishing off the stories in book one and keeping the momentum going to book three. Have you found that?
I absolutely did. It's exactly as you say, that book one raises the questions, book three answers them, so what do you do in book two? And that was part of my process for book two, from bringing it from bad to, I hope, good, was figuring out what the story of that book is, so that it does not just feel like you're in a holding pattern, but you feel like you're moving forward, you're moving deeper into the world, and learning more about it, and perhaps having some questions answered, even if some of the big questions are not yet answered.
Do you ever regret anything you'd written in book one? You painted yourself into a corner.
Yes, there's one thing I regretted. There's a little clue in book one I planted for something that pays off in book three, and I'm going to be mysterious. I would change one letter of that if I could.
Oh, how mysterious is that? The City of Secret Rivers by Jacob Segar Weinstein is published by Walker Books. Jacob's books are very funny, actually, and we haven't really touched on the humour in Arrowood, but it is a very funny book as well, in the midst of all this crime and earthiness. You must have enjoyed writing that.
I did. I really enjoyed writing it. In fact, the humour was one thing that my agent and my publisher also liked. And they asked me, could I put in more humour, which I couldn't do.
That's hard, isn't it? Be funnier, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, because I think if you're a stand-up comic, you can do that. You can write jokes. But when you just write a book, if something funny comes to you as you're writing it, that seems more a better way of doing it than trying to force humour in afterwards. So I didn't do that. There's bits that are hopefully quite funny.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you today, Mick. Arrowood by Mick Finlay is published by HarperCollins. We'll ask you the question that we ask all our guests. What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading What Are You Like by Anne Enright. Right. And I love Anne Enright.
Enjoying
it, then.
She's
a genius. Yeah, enjoying. Fantastic.
Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music, but heads up on the next show. The studio guest is Alex Phoebe, talking about his extraordinary novel, Lucia, which is based on the life of the daughter of James Joyce. We'll also hear from Gaynor Clements about the Cambridge Writing Retreat, which is set up in Ellsworth, just outside Cambridge, a beautiful place. And Alinka Rublack and Malcolm Gaskell will be talking to me about witchcraft and the books that they have written on that. All the old episodes of Bookmark are available on the Cambridge 105 website since the beginning of time, in fact, from the very beginning. They're all there, and that's cambridge105.co.uk. As I say, very much enjoyed talking to you, Mick. We'll sign out with your last choice of music now, which is Anne Peebles' It Was Jealousy. This didn't have to come from a very specific album. You just gave me the title and I just managed to download it. Why this one?
Because it makes a shiver go down my spine every time I hear the chorus. It's so full of emotion.
Blinded by a jealous moment, some foolish words